Afghanistan is not, in fact, a nation stuck in the Stone Age. You know, it's a nation of young people. You know, young Afghans are actively engaged with the outside world through social media, through technology. They care very much about 21st century ideas.
Welcome back to Immigrantly. I am your host, Sadia Khan. This week, we are bringing you an episode that is very close to my heart. Over the summer, I watched, along with the rest of the world, as over two decades of war in Afghanistan, quote-unquote, ended in a chaotic U.S. withdrawal. I was in Pakistan at the time. And believe it or not, my village is 6 hours' drive from Kabul. Most of the Afghans that America had promised to evacuate were left behind in Afghanistan under Taliban rule, a group that has made it explicitly clear they have no interest in protecting or respecting human rights. The scenes at Kabul airport leading up to the September 11th U.S. withdrawal deadline were nothing short of devastating.
Desperate to flee Taliban rule, Afghans are resorting to this, grasping at U.S. military aircraft and risking their lives. Some hung onto the wheels and fell to their death. Those left behind.
I'm sure a lot of you watched that. And amidst the chaos, a bombing by ISIS at the airport killed over 170 Afghans. Yet, President Biden stood by the U.S.'s withdrawal and placed blame on the Afghani people who have suffered decades of war and instability.
Afghanistan political leaders gave up and fled the country. The Afghan military collapsed, sometime without trying to fight.
Here I want to clarify. I am well aware that U.S. troop withdrawal was inevitable. To put it bluntly, U.S. was an occupier in Afghanistan, and therefore the troops leaving, however complicated, is the right thing to do. Having said that, this deeply harmful and blatantly wrong narrative about Afghanis is nothing new. For decades, Afghanis have been stripped of their humanity by narratives steeped in colonization and white supremacy. Today, I am so excited to have Khalid Hosseini on Immigrantly. Khalid Hosseini is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, The Kite Runner, A Thousand Splendid Suns, and The Mountains Echoed. He's also a U.S. Goodwill Envoy to the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, and founder of the Khalid Hosseini Foundation, a nonprofit that provides humanitarian assistance to the people of Afghanistan. Khalid's books are a window into the life of an Afghani, which makes it so special because Khalid doesn't claim to represent the entire population. Instead, he shares his lived experiences. For this conversation, I am also passing the mic to one of our content writers, Aliza Kazmi. Aliza is a first-generation Afghan and Pakistani-American. Yes, we all have multi-hyphenated identities on this show. It is part of what makes Immigrantly and us so special.
Thank you, Sadia. Yes, very multi-hyphenated. It's both a bit of a blessing and a curse, I have to admit. I mean, my entire life, I've been told by people that are supposed to be part of my community that I'm not Afghan enough, not Pakistani enough, and certainly not American enough. But I am still and always will be deeply proud of my Afghan identity, as well as my Pakistani and American identities. And even though I don't speak Farsi and I've never had the privilege of going to Afghanistan, I've always felt deeply connected to the country. I'm so grateful to have had the opportunity to speak with Khalid Hosseini. Growing up reading his books, they really offered a window into the Afghanistan that I didn't hear about on the news. And it helped me really picture the country that my parents and grandparents love to talk about so much. So let's jump right into it. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on Immigrant Lee. We are so happy to have you on the podcast. It is no secret that I am a big fan of your work. I'm curious, when you're writing your books, do you picture who the audience is going to be, and does that shape the stories in any way?
First of all, thank you for having me on your podcast, and thank you for your kind and generous words about my writing. You know, it's been a really wonderful thing. I've received so many letters and emails from young African-Americans like yourself who've never had the opportunity of actually living in Afghanistan, and my books have provided a window into the world of their parents and their relatives there. For me, when I'm writing, I write essentially for an audience of one. I write for myself. I climb down into a form of mental bunker where I try to close everything off, and I just engage directly with the material one-on-one. What I've found is that if I let other voices in, if I begin to worry about the concerns of this group or that group, that a kind of agenda enters the process, and inevitably it will pollute it. So I've written my books largely for myself. It's written the books largely because I've been deeply interested in the plight and the human drama of a set of characters. And I want to see it through, and I want to see what will happen to them, you know, who they are and how the arc of the story will transform them. And then whatever happens afterwards is largely a byproduct. So, for instance, it was not my aim in The Kite Runner to educate anybody on what Afghanistan looked like before the Soviet invasion, but it was necessary, indispensable to my storytelling. And therefore, the first 100 pages or so of The Kite Runner are centered in a world that is no longer a world of pre-Soviet war, 1970s Afghanistan, which happened to be the time and place where I was growing up there. And so the byproduct is it offers a window into that bygone world.
You've always been very adamant about not expressing that yourself as an expert on Afghanistan, and you at the end of the day are a writer and are bringing your own narratives to your work. And that's something that is I appreciate, right? Because I think that sometimes Afghanistan can be portrayed as a monolith in mainstream media, and perhaps the success of your novels and people have been claiming that, you know, it's a representation of Afghanistan is a testament to that people will grasp onto something a little bit outside of the mainstream and say that, oh, well, this is the story. It's a story. And so leaning into that a little bit, I'm curious, other than reading your books, what are some ways that non-Afghans can educate themselves about Afghanistan, and particularly about the current situation that we're seeing there?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, and with respect to my books, I have never intended my books to be a kind of exhaustive manifesto on all things Afghan. It frankly horrifies me when people at book signings tell me that everything they know about Afghanistan is derived from my books. I really cringe both inwardly and sometimes outwardly when I hear that. Because these are works of fiction, they're from a very narrow perspective, which is the narrow perspective of somebody who's lived in asylum for 40 years and is writing about the homeland he left when he was 11. So I'm always very careful to make sure that people understand that. But I do think that if people want to understand more about Afghanistan, you know, there's nothing as valuable as just talking to people. So if there are Afghans in your community, if, you know, your kid goes to school with an Afghan student and you know the parents, you know, talk to them. And one of the things I found is that Afghans are actually very generous in talking to people about their life and about their experiences and what they went through and what they think the country is going through, where they think the country is headed. So talking to Afghans in the community, be they in your school or in some kind of local group, is enormously valuable.
You know, I think what you said about the hyphenated identities, that's so much of being someone that lives in America. That's part of my identity. I'm Afghan, Pakistani, American, and there's just so much complicated nuance between all of those hyphens. And I think that sometimes people, whether or not you're a world-renowned writer or you're just a person living your day-to-day, are expected to be representatives of a nation. And we can't be, right? All we can do is guide people and educate them and help uplift stories, which I think you do beautifully. I want to talk a little bit about your refugee experience. As you mentioned, you came into the U.S. in the 1980s under asylum. You are also now a Goodwill Ambassador for the UN's refugee agency, the UNHCR. So you have a really great holistic view of the refugee experience. And I'm curious how you feel, or what you feel the similarities and differences are in the way that refugees are treated and talked about today than they were when you came to the U.S. in the 1980s.
Well, I came to the U.S. in 1980, and in March of that year, my family arrived in September, and in March of that year, then President Carter signed the American Refugee Act of 1980, which raised the refugee cap to 50,000 per year and allowed for a whole series of procedures through which the United States could receive and process refugees. There were systems in place when I arrived here to see to it that refugees were welcome, that were settled into communities, that they had access to Medicaid and Social Security cards and the rest of it. Refugee resettlement agencies in those days enjoyed bipartisan support in Congress and widespread public support, both in so-called red and blue states. I just think today the issue of refugees has become much more politicized. When Donald Trump was elected into office, he brought some significant changes to U.S. asylum laws. The U.S. admitted the lowest number of refugees it has since the signing of the Refugee Act in 1980 during the Trump administration. Refugee aid organizations were underfunded. They had to either downsize or close shops altogether. And if you look at public narratives today, you listen to the way that people talk about refugees, it tends to be much more polarized, and people tend to speak along party lines.
Is it really our responsibility to welcome thousands of potentially unvetted refugees from Afghanistan?
If history is any guide, and it's always a guide, we will see many refugees from Afghanistan resettle in our country in coming months, probably in your neighborhood.
You know, when I look at the way people speak about refugees today, there are two common tropes. They're either a kind of a monolithic community defined by victimhood and perpetual need on the one hand, or at the other end, they're an invading group of people who pose a security threat to otherwise safe American communities. Since we're talking about representation today, one of the things I've tried to do about in advocating for refugees is to address some of these tropes and to reach for representation that exists outside of these, I think, these two very extreme tropes. In my view, refugees, more than any other community, are in a better position to appreciate and understand the privileges of freedom, because they've paid such a high personal cost for the liberties that they've been given. So there's this, it's not to say that all refugees are exceptional. I think it's unfair to put that kind of pressure on refugees. Refugees should have the right to be mediocre like everybody else. But if you look at refugees on balance in this country, for instance, you see that what they really have done collectively as a group is bring innovation, is they've enriched our cultural institutions, they've enriched our public institutions. Within the refugee community, there's this very strong refugee ethos, and I think my parents were powerful examples of it, which is to be hardworking, to embrace education, to work towards being not only self-reliant, but to one day contribute to the host community that welcomed you. And the evidence bears that out. You know, if you look at refugees in the United States, Refugee-owned businesses, you know, pay billions of dollars every year in taxes to the building of roads and bridges and schools that you and I and millions of other fellow Americans benefit from.
You know, when you're talking about refugees are allowed to be mediocre, I think that's something I have to remind myself of all the time. I think I get trapped in a very American-centric narrative or trapped in that thinking. And it's like, we are all people, right? We make mistakes and we are imperfect. And I think what you're talking about, the monolithic, the stereotypes, the black and white of it all is where I think we're getting lost. And you talked obviously a lot about media representation or just representation in general. I'm curious, how do you feel that 20 plus years of very flawed mainstream media representation of Afghanistan and Afghan people has led to the situation that we see today in a humanitarian sense?
You know, there's this, I'm sure you know it, and many fellow Afghan Americans who are listening to this podcast or Afghans elsewhere or listening to this know this, that there's all these false mythologies around Afghanistan, which we hear all the time, that Afghanistan is ungovernable, that it's a lawless no man's land, that justice in Afghanistan is delivered through the barrel of a rifle, that it's a land of endless tribalism where women are silent and submissive and they're governed by men who are bearded and live in caves.
Afghan women know through hard experience what the rest of the world is discovering. The brutal oppression of women is a central goal of the terrorist.
And who are governed themselves by an uncompromising medieval religion. You know, the trope is that Afghans are warlike people, that they're always engaged in war, either with foreigners or among themselves. Forgetting very conveniently that for the vast majority of the 20th century, Afghanistan lived at peace with itself and with its neighbors, while Western nations engaged not in one, but two world wars that killed and displaced millions of people. You know, that's not to say that there's not elements of truth in some of those tropes, but you know, if you listen to the way that Afghans are represented and have been represented in the media, you'd almost be forgiven for thinking that the majority of Afghans are warlords or fanatics or drug dealers, instead of the reality, which, as is always the case, is far more banal and far more complicated, that the vast majority of Afghans are, you know, ordinary people. They're teachers, they're merchants, they're farmers, people who've, many of them have had to flee their homes because of violence and instability. Afghanistan is not, in fact, a nation stuck in the Stone Age. You know, it's a nation of young people, almost 70% are under the age of 25. I had the chance to go to Kabul and meet a lot of sort of young Afghan urban professionals in the urban centers in hubs like Kabul. You know, young Afghans are actively engaged with the outside world through social media, through technology. They care very much about 21st century ideas like social justice, like representation, like women's rights, like protecting the environment, and so forth. I just think that these myths and the perpetuation of these and tropes and misrepresentations are harmful because they inform the national dialogue around important issues. For instance, in the current moment, we're talking about you know, Afghans arriving in the United States, the admission of Afghan refugees in the United States. And if you listen to different media outlets, certainly conservative media outlets, Afghan asylum seekers are being painted as fanatics.
Afghanistan is the biggest national security threat.
And as invaders and as terrorists.
What do we do now that we have brought so many of them here?
I think these types of, you know, oversimplified narratives and caricatures that frame and permeate the political discourse and unfortunately close up space for what should be genuine dialogue and an expression of ideas.
you talk about young people, and that's something that I've heard a lot from, I don't want to say older folks, but in my Afghan elders, you know, I've, in August, when I was speaking to people within our community about what was going on in Afghanistan as the U.S. was withdrawing, so many of them were just tired. They said, I don't have much fight left in me. I'll do what I can. I'll donate and I'll do what I can, but I don't have the fight left in me. And I was part of an organizing effort of a global protest that occurred in August by mostly young Afghans to raise up our voices and to advocate on behalf of Afghans that were seeking asylum and a whole host of other things. But, you know, so many of us are disconnected from the country itself. I've never had the privilege of stepping foot in Kabul. I'm also, like I said, I am a hyphenated identity. So I am multiple things, though I have deep, deep love for Afghanistan. You definitely do not remember this, but we met way back when I was about 13 at an event. And I asked you to sign my copy of The Kite Runner, and you very kindly did. And I just found it recently, and you wrote in it, keep writing, because I'm sure I talked to you about wanting to be a writer. And that advice, I mean, it's carried me to where I am today. I still write. I'm still a writer. So I think that's a testament to the power of talking to younger generations and guiding them in some way. And, you know, you yourself have raised children in America. So I'm curious what you think, how the younger generations, as we have more and more generations that don't have the opportunity to go to Afghanistan, how can we stay connected to a culture and a country that we've never seen and continue to fight for it? Because it doesn't really seem like anyone's going to do the fight for us.
No, it's something that we have to do. Now, I remember when my family arrived here in September of 1980, we were exhausted from travel. And that night before we went to bed, my dad gave all of us kids one aspirin each. I guess he thought it helped jet lag. I don't know why he thought that. But he kind of gave us over the next few days in a series of sort of either individual or group conversations in a kind of a fragmented way, a kind of words of advice that he gave us. And I guess I would sum it up as saying that, look, as Afghans that have now come to the United States, where you find yourself is a privilege and it's not a right. You've been given an opportunity to forge a meaningful life, to help build a community, to be part of it and share in its hopes and in its aspirations. You have a chance to work hard for what you want, to study hard. You have a chance to set an example for others, and you have a chance and in fact a responsibility to be a credit to your family and to your community, and to always remember where you came from. And that always stuck with me, I guess, in ways that I've never openly acknowledged, I guess, but I believe it's been in sort of an operating in my head for a long time. That's been a guiding principle of mine through my life here in the United States as somebody living in asylum. And I realize that that advice is not earth-shattering, and that probably countless immigrant parents have given that same series of advice to their kids, but it's sound enough, and I think it still holds true today. But as far as the, you know, how the Afghan American community can stay together, and what I can say to them that would be helpful, I'll be honest, I'm far more modest when it comes to that. I'm actually much more into the business of learning from young Afghan Americans than I am of passing anything to them and advising them on anything. I think I'm really inspired by the success and innovations of so many young Afghan Americans, whether it be in technology, in finance, in commerce. You know, frankly, people like yourself who are leading communities and setting an example and guiding important conversations about important issues. If I look at the present moment, I'm just really uplifted by the way young Afghan Americans, many of whom have never set foot in Afghanistan and only know it through the stories of their elders or through the reading of books, how so many of them have joined hands across the United States to welcome their fellow Afghan refugees as they come to the United States. They've volunteered for refugee resettlement agencies. They've donated items on wish lists. They've offered their homes as temporary residences for arriving refugees. You know, I think it's so inspiring that how they've shown a real sense of common purpose and solidarity.
This episode is brought to you by Stamps.com. If you are a small business owner, you know how much hard work and effort goes into maintaining a small business. I know because I am an indie podcaster. So if you've got a small business, you know that there is nothing more valuable than your time. So stop wasting it on trips to the post office. Stamps.com makes it easy to mail and ship right from your computer. Stamps.com basically brings the services of the US Postal Service and UPS shipping right to your computer. Whether you're in an office sending invoices, a side hustle, Etsy shop, or a full-blown warehouse shipping out orders, Stamps.com will make your life easier. All you need is a computer and standard printer. No special supplies or equipment, and within minutes, believe you me, within minutes, you're up and running, printing official postage for any letter, any package, anywhere you want to send. Once your mail is ready, just schedule a pickup or drop it off. No traffic, no lines. There is no risk. And with my promo code POD, P-O-D, you get a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in POD, P-O-D. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again.
The advice that your dad gave you is really powerful and very heavy. And I think that is something that I've been grappling with a little bit, of this idea of the pressure that we put on ourselves because we consider ourselves to be representatives of a nation, right? And that's heavy. And you have explored intergenerational trauma in your books. And that's something that I think is very much a part of the conversation, right? Is being cognizant of not passing down trauma or trying to unpack the trauma that we have. And the trauma of war is so deep, and the trauma of displacement is so deep. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that, about, yes, while we have an immense responsibility to advocate for our country and still fight for it, how do we care for ourselves? How do you care for yourself?
Well, I think you live an authentic life to the best ability that you have. You know, you do the best with what you have. I think my father's advice holds true. It's whether I wanted to or not, it's kind of been something that's been at the center of my life, that I've built my life around. I don't spend too much time thinking about my responsibilities per se. I know that my children don't, but I think it is important. You know, for instance, in my household, since the day that my kids were born, we had no illusions about those kids, my son and my daughter, having a connection with Afghanistan that in any way approached the one that I have, having lived there, spent my formative years there. But it is important to me that they understand where they come from, that they understand the traditions and the customs and the culture that directly or indirectly shaped who they are, and that begins with language for me. And so, you know, we've done everything we could in our household to make sure that our kids can understand the language that I grew up speaking, which is Dari, and that they can read it and that they can write it, because I feel that language is to put it in a kind of a facile, cliched analogy, that it's sort of the key that lets you into all the different rooms in a house, if house is a culture. So that's very important. At the same time, I realize that they have their own lives that they're living, that they're essentially Americans that are growing up in this country with many of the interests and concerns and preoccupations that ordinary Americans have. But I think their life is only enriched in ways that they may not appreciate yet as children, but that they will when they're your age, that this facet of their personality actually enriches who they are and actually deepens their understanding of themselves, of their family, of their background, and of how they fit into the world.
Yeah, language definitely is a key. And as someone that lacks that key, I hope that carries even more weight, because not having language and not having access to the language of my ancestors is devastating and something that I am always trying to remedy and learn where I can. I want to talk actually about your most recent book, Sea Prayer, which is a beautiful illustrated piece of fiction that you say was inspired by the story of Alan Kurdi, who was a three-year-old boy from Syria who passed away while trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea, and more specifically, the moral outrage that you felt. And I think that was the last time I can really pinpoint global outrage about the refugee crisis, but that same crisis is continuing today, as we've talked about, and I really fear that the rage is faltering because the situation has become so normalized. What are your thoughts on that? How do we keep the rage going, or do we need to channel a different type of emotion?
No, I think it's strange that we can be utterly gutted and inspired to act by a single story, while, you know, paradoxically, larger scale human suffering registers with us as abstraction. And I think the story of the tragedy of poor Alan Kurdi is a perfect illustration. You know, refugees and migrants had been dying in the Mediterranean by the thousands long before Alan Kurdi did. But, you know, that one photograph, that powerful photograph, told a story. It told a story of a young life wasted, a story of a family in despair, of a country in ruins, and, you know, and the seeming indifference of the world, you know, in the wake of that terrible picture going viral, internet searches for Syria and refugees went through the roof, and refugee aid organizations received exponential growth, experienced exponential growth in donations. And I guess in some ways it's counterintuitive, and in other ways it's not, because we are, you know, at the end of the day, as humans, we are a species that's wired for metaphor. We, in order for us to experience any kind of meaningful internal shift, we have to be invited into the experience of others, where hopefully we'll run into something that catches. Something that speaks to us, that angers us, that outrages us, that moves us, that touches us, that makes us laugh, makes us angry. So you asked the question of what can we do? I'm under no illusion that storytelling is enough, because at the end of the day, we need states to act together in solidarity. We need funding. We need policy change. But storytelling is an incredibly essential and powerful tool in that process, because all the things that I mentioned, the policy change on all those things, live downstream from culture. And so we have to get people to care. We have to get people to feel a personal connection in whatever small way with the plight of millions of fellow human beings. And so that's why I continue to work with the UNHCR, and that's why I continue to listen to stories and to distribute them and tell those stories, because at the end of the day, I think that's the most powerful teacher of empathy that we have. And for any kind of action to happen, you have to get people to care first.
In an interview that you did in 2014, the interviewer asked you, the war was winding down even then, and they said, there's a fear that as the war in Afghanistan comes to an end, that the country could slip away if the world doesn't watch. But right now, it feels like the country is slipping away as the world watches. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I'm like you. I imagine the way you are and your parents are. I'm left with dread and an open-ended worry. I worry about where the country is headed. You say the world is watching as Afghanistan falls away. Well, Afghanistan is slowly falling away toward what could be a humanitarian catastrophe. It's important to take a couple of minutes to talk about this. Because Afghanistan, I'm not sure how many people in your audience realize, but Afghanistan is on the verge of collapse. This is a country that was an impoverished nation in the best of days, even in the halcyon days of the 1970s that I repeatedly refer to. The economy of the country for the last 20 years has depended almost entirely on foreign aid. It's what propped up the country, and now that the Taliban have come back, the central bank's $9 billion in reserves, most of which were held in the U.S., have been frozen. The IMF is holding another $435 million out of concern for, quote, a lack of clarity around the new regime. And so in a country where millions of people are living at or below poverty line already, the fear is that a severe economic downturn will push millions of more Afghans into despair and poverty, and cause the kinds of mass exodus that we saw in the 80s and 90s. It's also worth mentioning that the Taliban are now holding the reins to a country where one out of three people live with food insecurity. As you and I are talking on this podcast right now, 14 million Afghans don't know where the next meal is coming from. 2 million Afghan children are living with acute malnourishment, and it's estimated that in the next year, half the kids under the age of 5 will suffer from malnourishment. This is further exacerbated, unfortunately, by the fact that Afghanistan has been hit hard by climate change. There's a terrible drought going on in Afghanistan right now. It comes on the heels of an already terrible drought in 2018 that saw farmers sell their equipments and their lands and their livestock, often at a loss just to make ends meet. It's estimated now that 40% of crops will be lost this year and that livestock will be decimated. And so that obviously compounds the concerns that we have over food insecurity and displacement. And as a final piece to this already distressing picture is the fact that this is all happening in the midst of rising cases of COVID-19, especially the Delta variant, and a healthcare system in Afghanistan that is on the verge of collapse. You know, so many international aid workers and skilled Afghan aid workers have left the country. So all this paints a fairly concerning picture of an Afghanistan that may be weeks to months about to come. And so I think, as the international community watches what's going on in Afghanistan, it has a tough decision to make. They need to make a decision that balances, on the one hand, their, I think, understandable concerns about the new regime, given its track record, and on the other hand, with preventing a massive humanitarian catastrophe and addressing the needs of a population that is losing by the millions access to basic goods and services, and what the destabilizing of that country means not only for the people of Afghanistan, but also for the region. So that's where I think the international community is and the decision that they have to make.
It is a devastating picture that you paint, that is the reality. And we've talked about the ways that immigrantly listeners, right, non-international community members can educate themselves about Afghanistan, but what can they do? Can they do anything in this moment to help?
Oh, sure. Sure you can. There's a lot of things you can do. You know, there are tens of thousands of Afghan refugees arriving in the United States. So if you want to focus on those refugees coming to the United States, you can help so much. And I can speak about this from my own personal experience and how much it meant to my family when members of the community stepped up, both Afghan and non, to help us with just simple things like how to get a driver's license, how to get a get to the DMV, how to apply for a job, how to make a doctor's appointment, all those simple things. So much people can do. People can volunteer for refugee resettlement agencies. They have seen a real uptick in volunteer applications. Every refugee resettlement agency has a wish list of items that they need, clothing, toys, so on and so forth, furniture. So you can donate. And you can also write to your leaders in Congress, you know, and ask that Afghanistan not be forgotten, that the rights of ordinary Afghans, particularly women and girls in Afghanistan, that they work together to apply appropriate political pressure on the regime in Afghanistan to respect the essential human rights of Afghanistan, and to write to their leaders and say that, you know, while the country is deciding on a political strategy and whether to recognize the Taliban as a legitimate government or not, it must not forget the fact that there are millions of people who are losing access to services, millions of people who are struggling with very basic things like shelter and food. You know, over 600,000 people in Afghanistan have become displaced since the beginning of this year. It's mostly internally inside Afghanistan, but it could be just a matter of time before they head for international borders for protection. So advocate for those people, advocate for the neighboring countries to keep their borders open, advocate for the funding of those agencies that safeguard and protect the rights of displaced people and provide life-saving emergency services to people who are displaced and who cross international borders. So there's a lot of things you can do, from small, very granular, to sort of more macro. Lots of different ways you can help and get involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll be sure to share a whole breadth of resources on our social media channels, from things that people can do, from calling their members of Congress to donating goods and funds. So as we are wrapping up, and I do want to be mindful of the time, I have to ask the question I think everyone wants to ask: what are you working on? Do you have any projects, books in the works that you want to share with us, or anything in your UN work that you'd like to share with us?
Nothing that I want to share, frankly. I've learned that lesson long ago, not to share anything about work in progress. I have to say that I was at work on a novel and a couple of different writing projects, but everything that I've been working on has been put on hold because of what's happened in Afghanistan, and I'm focusing all my energies right now in working with my foundation and partners in the community and different NGOs to address issues that are going on in Afghanistan, and also to address issues facing Afghans who will be arriving here in the United States as refugees.
So on Immigrantly, we typically wrap up with this question. If you could describe America in a word or a phrase, how would you do that?
That's really tough. You know, it's tough. You know, one of my favorite artists is Bruce Springsteen, and he has a lovely line in one of his songs that says, "God have mercy on the man who doubts what he's sure of." And it seems to me that here in the United States, we are doubting a whole slew of things that we used to be sure of. You know, from the benefits of a free press to the moral rightness of our asylum policies, to faith in our scientific community, to the integrity of our elections. So, you know, in 2021, how else to define America but, you know, a land caught in a potentially existential struggle over how to define America? I think that's the central question facing this country right now.
That might be my favorite answer we've ever gotten. I think that perfectly sums it up. I wanted to give you the opportunity to answer the same question about Afghanistan. So if you were to describe Afghanistan in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
Let me stick to something very simple. I think Afghanistan is home to the single greatest bread on the planet.
That is an incredible answer, and I've heard the same from my grandfather, that I will never know bread like it was in Afghanistan.
So. I get letters from U.S. service members, men and women, who served in Afghanistan, and who tell me what a pleasure it was to meet ordinary Afghans in villages and in cities, but they tell me that one of the things they will miss the most is that wonderful naan.
Before we wrap up, is there anything else that you wanted to touch on that we haven't got a chance to today?
No, I think we touched on a lot of things. I appreciate everything you do, and I appreciate having voices like yourself in our community. I think they're essential, and thank you for making time for me today.
That's our show. In a few weeks, we will be releasing a special episode of Immigrant Tea with an Afghan journalist to dive into the current state of media in the country under Taliban rule. To learn more about that episode and stay in the loop on all things Immigrant Tea, be sure to follow us on Twitter at @immigrantly_pod and on Instagram at @immigrantlypod. Take care. Thank you.